Thank you very much for coming for this reception, and thank you very much for organizing it. I am in my visit here to Australia. I have been to Australia many times and seen the main cities. It's a beautiful country, beautiful cities, and every time I see a city, I say, that's a beautiful place, and I go to the next city, and it is also a beautiful place. And congratulations, the city is really, cities are really beautiful, and people are nice, and Australia, in our business, basically, I remember 10 years ago when we look at how many containers we handle in Dubai, and at that time we just touched 1 million. And someone told me, well, you know, the whole Australia doesn't handle more than 1.5 million. That was maybe, I don't know, 15 years ago. And if you really asked at that time someone and said, well, and you ask economics, or economists or consultants, which I learned not to listen to them a lot. And you would have said, we handle 1.5 million in Australia. What do you think we'll handle? When will we double it? They wouldn't tell you we'll double it in 10 years. But today, Australia handles 5 million. I started in the port business. I started 25 years ago in the port. Actually, my role was in the customs. And at that time, we built a very large port. But I think I want to go back a little bit to talk about Dubai a little bit, because if we talk about what we do, we cannot neglect the phenomena of Dubai, because everybody hears in the news about Dubai, and they write a lot about us in the paper, in the media. But it's not because we spend a lot of money on media relations or an advertisement. It's actually some of the interesting projects we built made people write about us and show films about us, whether it is a show, Discovery Channel or National Geographic or anyone in any business. Our economy in Dubai never been built on oil. It is actually in the early 70s, before the 70s, we had, before oil was discovered, we had most of the necessary infrastructure. We had some running water, we had some power. When oil was discovered in the 1969, the news was, yes, you have oil, but you don't have much, and it's not going to last long. They expected oil to last 25 years, so we had to really work hard to diversify our economy. At that time, the maximum production of oil was 350,000 barrels, which really, in the next maybe about 15 years ago, it dropped to 150, and I don't think now we produce more than 90,000. The oil in our economy is not more than 5% role. Now, we had a few choices to do, or very limited choices. Either we will say, well, we are not blessed with oil like everybody else, and we will wait for somebody to help us, or really we have to do something about it. Now, living in that area, no wonder you don't find many people. Our population is very low in that area, naturally, because the environment there is very harsh. It's a desert, very limited water, very limited agriculture, hardly any, hardly getting any rain, no rivers. Our great grandfathers, for water, they have to walk for days, every day, to find water. So we never got it so easy. We survived the desert. And it's not like us that we say, well, we don't have oil and we're going to sit here waiting for somebody to help us. We've been traders. We've been surviving with trade, with commerce, and we have actually built excellent commerce relations with Africa, with the Gulf countries, with India. And the biggest trade for us was pearling. And people used to go and dive for the pearls, and they used to sell it to India. And India, they had a Maharaja system at that time, which is the main buyers. But then two things happened almost simultaneously. One of them is that Japanese discovered cultured pearls, which basically killed the business. At the same time, also, the Maharaja system was abolished, and we have no buyers for our pearls. So people survived many, many they've been used to survive, I think, many difficult times, and they overcome them. So people learned how to overcome them. They started to trade with Africa, with timber, with spices, gold to India, and many, many other products. And merchants found Dubai a place that welcomes business. And it is a cosmopolitan society because we always lived with many foreign people who come and do business with us. You will hear a lot about Dubai and why Dubai is such an economic boom and why the neighbors don't have that, even though financially they're stronger and they had oil and they have many resources. It is because we continue to build our country, we continue to develop, and we don't get distracted. There have been many distractions in the 1979. Actually, Jebel Ali as a port was built with great hopes that when we first discovered oil, we said, let's invest our money in the port operation. Very simple, because the backbone of the economy is commerce, and commerce thrives if you have a port that has the facilities and has. And so when oil was discovered immediately, the first thing was is to build a port, which was the old port of Dubai, the first one. It was supposed to be 15 berths, and by the time they finished, they were 35 berths. At the same time, there were about 200 vessels waiting to enter just because we had the port. And so immediately the government said, well, we need to build a bigger one. At the same time, we built a big dry dock. At that time, it was designed to accommodate 1 million-ton vessel, thinking that if they build a big vessel, we'll be able to handle it. Of course, there are no more million-ton vessel. I didn't think they ever build one. The largest was 600 or 700,000, which was scrapped. But the dry dock is there, and the dry dock is big. Everything was finished almost toward 1980-81. At the same time, two very big neighbors around us, strong in population, rich, decided to have a war, and that was Iran and Iraq, and a war that lasted 10 years. Nobody knew how long it was going to last. Nobody expected it to happen, and nobody knew even to what extent it's going to take. A lot of people made some assumptions. It could reach us. It could affect our business. And everyone in the region, the neighbors, decided to stop all their project, to freeze any investment, because they didn't know how this war is going to affect them. We did not. We continued to invest. And I think I remember, even though the port was finished in 79, immediately it started the operation. And the free zone was announced in 85. And there was a study on the free zone, actually, which was a study the government made to convert Jebel Ali into a free zone. That was finished in 1980. I joined 1982 in the customs. And I remember when His Highness was talking to people about, you know, we should put a free zone and all that. And he just, I happened to be there, and he said, do you think it's a good idea? I said, yes. And then when they did the decree for it, he surprised me. He said, do you think it's going to work? Apparently, I was maybe one of the few who said, yes, it will work. Many people said, is it going to work? Many businessmen in Dubai said, it's not going to work. It's there's nothing you could do. Jebel Ali is a white elephant. It's a huge project of 16 kilometers of quay wall in one go. Was built, one of the largest in the world. And now there is a war around you. Why would somebody come? And then I was surprised when Sheikh Mohammed said, well, if you really believe, you are in it. And I said, what a mistake I made, because I am trained as a custom officer. And so all my mind was regarding customs and how to stop people from smuggling, on how to control something that comes in, and how to ensure the government income is there. And then I'm going to be in free zone. So I had a vacation, which I deliberately did in the summer, to visit some important free zones around the world. I went to Singapore, Hong Kong, Korea, Taiwan, and then went to States and visited also some of their foreign trade zones, and learned something about what they did, and came back and felt that we should do something different, or something that complements what they did. Of course, most of the operation was logistics, some manufacturing, some distribution. And we started to operate the port. The port operated with not much of a success, actually, in the beginning. But the region has seen many crises. When the war ended in 88, Iraq decided to occupy Kuwait. That was 1990. So we just had a year of really peace. And then again, the Iraq. And then, of course, post the occupation, liberation, and sanctions in Iraq, and all these headaches. And then again, September 11. And before September 11, we had the Far East crisis, when the barrel of oil went to $10, when the Far East couldn't buy any more things. And all these crises that came on September 11, after September 11, and all these, the reaction of the neighbors always been stop. Any ministry, any government department that's going to build a big project, they will stop it and shelf it. And that interruption in the economy had had an adverse effect in their economy, while in our case, we kept building. I remember in 87, they were shooting tankers, and there was a premium, an insurance premium on anything that been shipped. And if you ship a 20-foot container from Japan to Dubai, at that time, $1,500, the insurance premium was $1,500. And that was a difficult situation. But again, as a port, we have 7 ports competing with us in Dubai. Anyway, and many ports in the Gulf. But we were always, all of us were really suffering from the insurance premium. So no shipping line will tell me, well, the insurance is too expensive in Dubai, because it's expensive every. The minute you enter the Gulf, the war risk insurance premium kicks in and you have to pay it. So we were no worse off than anybody else. We had nearly no reason to go and do something about this. And we decided to do something about it. So we had to be creative, and we went out to Lloyd's and we agreed with them that we will put $150 million, our own money, and told them any ship that is destined to our port should not have the war risk insurance on the product. And we took a risk, because if they've hit one ship, I think if they hit one and then we lose that, we will probably would have stopped. But we took a gamble. Nothing happened. But interesting, most of the cargo started to come to us. I was surprised and not surprised, because some of the shipping line, for example, took our offer, but many didn't. And then I realized that the war risk insurance that they pay maybe $300, but they charge the customer another $1,200. So, of course, for them, they're going to lose money if they take our offer. But many took, actually, our offer. And many consignees came and said to the shipper, I don't want your insurance. I'm going to take the risk. This kind of proactive approach and this kind of creative approach helped us with our customers. We had a port that was almost empty. We had a big port in Dubai, which was working, was very busy, but the port of Jebel Ali was not. And we have been visiting our customer, the shipping line, around the world, trying to attract them to come to Jebel Ali. But I tell you, we learned one thing, that the shipping line have no loyalty, no matter what you do. If you have the best port, the best equipment, if somebody offers them something less, they'll go somewhere else. But one thing important, the only way to protect and keep the shipping line is if you have the cargo. We gained so much knowledge about the port business. We gained so much knowledge and relation with our customers that they trusted us. This is something, is not that something you can learn in universities or you can gain it by reading books. It's really something you have to go through it for many years. You have to go through dealing with them, understanding their business, reacting to their problems, and solving them. And you will earn, which we did, some kind of trust and confidence that they know if they bring a vessel, you can handle it. Because nothing worse for them than the vessel will come and nobody can handle it, or being in a port which cannot really live to the promises. A port business involves a lot of investment. It's not just the infrastructure and the key wall, it's the equipment. And the gamble with the equipment is that they build vessels bigger, wider, and then we have to build cranes for them. And cranes are not something you pick up off the shelf. These things, by the time you have your specs,
ready
to tender, you talk about 2 years at least before you receive the cranes. So it's not something that you say, they're going to come in 2 months, I better buy equipment. No. You have to have them ready and take a gamble that they will come. And if they don't, then you end up with idle equipment. We took a gamble, but it's a calculated risk because we know the shipping line and they know us very well. Our first port operation was in Jeddah, which was early 2000. When Jeddah decided to privatize, Maersk Line came to us and said, why don't you bid for Jeddah? And we really didn't want to because we were happy in a protective place. We competed with everybody else in there. And we have been, the reason they wanted us to go there is that our service was so good. We had decided in the early 90s to have a premium service. The premium service means putting cranes, anticipating demand and putting cranes bigger than what you need, ample equipment, and excess capacity. That is something the shipping line enjoyed, and that's something we did. And I remember when we wanted to do it, we had a meeting, and we had a finance director, and of course, finance people are always the people who are going to tell you what could go wrong all the time. And they will anticipate it, and they will be very, because they are the people eventually who's going to find the money for you. And we listened, and the director of finance came to me and said, you know, don't get carried away by all these marketing people. Marketing people could get you in trouble because they will convince you of many things. They want to sell anything at any price. And the finance people are the ones who want to put the brakes. So we have to be something in between. But he told me, if we do the premium service, you will realize you will have a lot of cranes up, which means the cranes are not operating. The boom will be up. We listened, but we didn't listen to him. We went and bought equipment and actually equipped the port, borrowed from the bank some money, and we told them we were going to pay them 1992, 10 years we decided to pay them, but we paid them in 96. And that was good, and that built some confidence with the customers. So when Maersk asked us to go for bid for Jeddah, we did because we want something to attach the customers more to us. And if they want us to go somewhere, then this is like scoring some good points with them, which will let them be more receptive in giving us other services in somewhere else. But when we did Jeddah, we had only one port. And we have to have, once you run a port outside, somewhere else, you have to have an international division that deals with these businesses. So we have the marketing people, the operation people, the IT people. They're all geared for one port. And we have an Arab Muhammad Sharaf, who was CEO. When I appointed him from as a marketing, he was a marketing man, and I appointed him as the head of Dubai Port International. He didn't want to because he said, I'm going to be involved in one port, doing hardly anything. Anyway, I told him, you got to find something to do. So he started looking. He eventually got Djibouti, which is a very interesting port, across from Aden, and then India, and then Romania. And that compounded our problem because here we have a lot of demand on our time, but very little business. It's places where people didn't want to go, except Jeddah was very popular as a port because it was the first port that comes from the Mediterranean after the Suez Canal. The next one is we have to, I think, acquire a company, and that is when we end up with Adelaide because we bought CSX. It was easier to do. We thought of P&O, but we thought that's such an expensive thing, we cannot finance it. Let's go for something less expensive. When we bought CSX, we end up with Adelaide. We end up with two terminals in Hong Kong, Yantin, Tangen. Qingdao was not a port, was just a concession agreement that haven't been signed even. And, of course, Germany, Germanshall in Germany, San Domingo, and Port Callao in Port Cabello, actually, in Venezuela. Those actually were not in the place where all the customers wanted to go. And many people thought we would sell our port. But people didn't realize that port is very close to us and it's a core business. We don't sell our core business. We expand it. We invest in it. We gamble in it. We did it many times. And We had a port in Hong Kong, which I remember they used to call it the concrete terminal because it has been always losing money with CSX. It was, I believe, CT7. And CT3 was our terminal that's across from the ATL, which is a huge logistic building, multi-level. And the CT7 had two cranes and had no business at all. And when we announced, the next day all the newspaper asked me, when are we going to sell it, CT7? And we said, we're not selling it. And when I finished my PhD, you realize we're losing $12 million a year on that. I said, well, we better do something about it. But a year later, we took over P&O, which gave us unbelievable locations that customers wanted. And immediately that port was occupied, and that port is making $20 million from a loss. Why? Because the customers in the past, we were not in the best locations. So if we ask MSC, for example, come and give us business there, they don't want to upset Hutch, who is helping them in not only in Hong Kong, but in Europe. And so when we acquired P&O and we ended up with Le Havre and Marseille and Antwerp and now Rotterdam, immediately they felt that they can go. And if Hutch would be unhappy, we're already serving them in Europe and in most parts of the world. And that, I think, the synergy today with all the 42 terminals, 43 terminals that we have are in key locations. An important location, of course, is India, as well as China. All the growth, every shipping company and anyone who's in the port business looks at China and India simply because they have the population that is in demand for the most luxurious. Both countries had almost socialist system. Both countries were closed economy. Suddenly, they have the new wealth that came to them. Suddenly, they are interested in all the luxury items. And naturally, big growth. China is going like 25%. And it's a double digit that is very hard to conceive and very hard to deal with. And we managed to acquire ports in that area. In fact, we are the main port operator in India. And we have very good terminals in China. And all that gave us excellent relation with the customers. So whenever we have a port that we operate, the customers will always choose us over other operators because they know that the only port operator today who can help shipping lines in India is us. We are running 6 ports in a place that is one of the most difficult. You can handle a vessel in 48 hours, or you can end up handling it for 2 weeks. It's a nightmare to do road transport in India. You maybe go from one port to another by sea. So the knowledge that we have, the relation with the customers, coupled with the premium service that we have convinced our customer to have, and the fact that we are in strategic locations made our ports very popular. And today we have across the board, 16% growth in our business. Jebel Ali Port alone, we have to provide 2 million containers every year. That means 2 million containers going to come every year additionally to what we have, which we have to build more key walls, invest in key walls, as well as invest in equipment. And I have a lot of memory about Jebel Ali when it hardly has nothing. And I remember we sit all day. There was not much business in the port anyway. And we at that time, we work until 5. Everybody else works until 1 in Dubai. But we had an American company running the port, which was Sealand, and they work until 5. And we sit until 5 doing nothing. Very little business. So to remember a port that is 16 kilometers and to think, if somebody told me one day we need to fill it, I wouldn't believe it. I would have bet on it. And now we have to reclaim outside the port. The port is not enough. And this tremendous growth that's coming. And amazingly, the rate we charge are more than all the others in Dubai. The rate is related to the service. So the shipping lines, they know that they're getting the service that requires that there is a good rate. So the others are paying much less than us but the service is not as good. And the customers, they know. The shipping line, they know that today to buy cranes, we used to buy cranes in the past for $3 million. Today the crane is $12 million. The demand on huge equipment. We had the crane that we have in Dubai handles. You know about twin lifts. That one handles four containers at the same time. And there is one now we heard that can handle eight, and we're going to get it. So the investment reflected a lot on our rate. We don't have the habit of raising rates, but when things are expensive, we have a dialogue with our customer. We tell them, well, you are demanding that we put this equipment, you are demanding that we put this system, and this system needs big investment, and how do you finance it? And we work with them. We never surprise them. We have never lived in a monopolistic climate. Always we had competition around us, always on our toes, but we decided to give the high end, the best service to people. And that what made us different than the others. In addition to our port business, we are also into shipbuilding and dry docks and repairs. And our dry dock, as I mentioned, is a huge dry dock, five docks. One of them is floating, and one of them can handle a million-ton vessel. We put three or four in them, in that one. We just reclaimed an area next to it, about 26 million square feet for ship repairs. That, again, is a nice business. In fact, the dry dock is probably their books are closed for the next 3 years. They cannot handle any more business. And we just bought a dry dock in Singapore and in Batam in Indonesia. And that is a nice business. A company called Pine United, we acquired almost 84%. Last time I remember, 84% of the company. And we run it. It has a nice business. And will give us also an opportunity to serve the customer that come to us in Singapore. In addition to the business that I just mentioned, the port and repairs, under Dubai World, we have also a real estate business. Investment, acquisitions. This is something we started in 97. In the beginning, it was really just to build some accommodation very close to the port, because we have many people in the free zone who want to live close to the port. But then we did it, and we felt it's a good business. Maybe we should be in it. But we wanted also to be in a unique situation, just like the port. What can we give that nobody else has? How do we distinguish ourselves from the competition? How can we offer somebody something that they cannot get it somewhere else? And we decided to go into offering accommodation in the waterfront. We have a small waterfront in Dubai. It's 60 kilometers, the whole city, and most of it is port and desalination and power plant. And so we went into reclamation. We decided to reclaim, to build, to create beachfront properties, and that's when we came up with the palm. The palm was not actually a design as a palm, it was designed as an island, but because we needed more beachfront, eventually it evolved. Even the trunk of the palm was just a causeway. And then we looked at how much it cost to build this causeway, and where do we make the money? And we decided, well, if we build it, maybe we add more sand and we put some hotels and some apartments. And so it evolved and eventually ended up with a palm. And then when we tender the contract, we got such a good price, we decided to build another one, two at the same time. One next to the port, which helped us when we dredged the port, actually, to dump the sand. And today, we're doing a lot of dredging. The palm, the first palm, second palm, and third palm, the world island, 300 islands, which these are all finished, reclaimed. In fact, by the time we finish our reclamation completely, we would have added 1,500 kilometers to the beach. But we started about only 5 years ago, and so in the last 5 years, we finished 800 kilometers. At the same time, we finished about 80,000 units of apartments and villas, plus two shopping centers and some office space. So in 5 years, it wasn't bad, actually, to do that. The advantage was that there were so many contractors with hardly anything to do, so we took advantage of that. I don't believe the next 5 years we could build as much as we did last time. The property business went very well for us, and we started to actually started to promote ourselves overseas. We established a company. I remember about 4 years ago, we had many people coming to us into investment in other things, and we said, maybe we should really bring a consultant to give us an advice whether an investment company could be something good for us. And we asked one of the top consulting companies who do feasibilities, and I'm not going to mention their names, but I know the CEO very well, and he had a cup of tea with me. He told me, fine, he's going to go think about how do we structure such investment company, because we have the property, we have the port, but people coming to us to buy shares in a bank or to do something, and we didn't know whether we could go something like that. Anyway, in 2 weeks he came to me as he promised, and he wasn't carrying any file to show me how to do it. He just came empty-handed. I thought maybe he emailed it, but he didn't. He told me, I'm just going to tell you verbally, don't do this because it's not going to work. And you have no idea. I understand the port business. You know it very well. You could do it. Property, you've done it. You passed the learning curve. But this is investment. It involves far more than what you have with your people. And there is no opportunity, we believe, as a company, knowing you for a long time, that you could have an advantage in doing. But when he left, I wasn't convinced, and I told my people, you know, I know we could do it. We had succeeded in many things. We can get the right people who know this business, and we will go in it. So we did, and we invested $1.5 billion in this company. And today, 3.5 years ago, 4 years now, the company has an enterprise value of $15 billion. It owns hotels in America. It owns hotels in various places around the world. It is we own a huge waterfront project in Cape Town. It's the largest, actually, project of waterfront project in South Africa. We invested in shares in Standard Chartered. We have 3% almost. We established our own mortgage company because we are selling a lot of real estate, and we felt that someday the banks are going to run out of allocation for real estate, and they could really kill our business if they decided not to lend money. So we had our own mortgage company that gave us, actually, we competed with the banks and started to lend people some money. And also we decided to establish a company that will basically take the mortgages, a securitization company which will take the mortgages and issue them into bonds in Europe so we can recycle the money. So yes, we lend money, and by the time we reach a certain level, we take that and we go to Europe or America, we launch them, we issue some bonds, and we bring back the money. And it worked very well for us in real estate. So in my trip here also, I'm looking at other opportunities for the sister companies. We have about 20 companies. I'm looking around, and I'm going to come to them. We have a criteria in our investment strategy. If we buy something, we keep it for 5 years at least. We are not people who will speculate. My worry is that people could get carried away in the success that we had, that they will buy something thinking that I can flip it next year. That's the biggest risk. I don't want to take that risk. And I said, no, whatever we buy has to stay 5 years and has to have an IRR of at least 20%. If it is less, they have to come and convince us why. Is there a growth opportunity? Is there something else we don't know? But they cannot just go and buy things to flip them the next day. That's a tendency that could bring consequences that we don't really want to deal with, and we don't have the capability of dealing with. And also allows us really to keep something, because I'm another person who likes to sell, even properties. I like to keep. And so when it stays with us 5 years, we will know. If we really don't want it, then we will flip it. But by that time, we would have got our IRR, and if the market didn't move, maybe we get rid of it. But this is our strategy, very clear ideas of what we want to do. In the hotels, we have the high-end hotels. We have a brand called One and Only, which we acquired majority shareholder from Kersner, who are running it. And it's a very interesting business, and we have repeat customers coming to it. So I'm looking at locations. I'll go back to the hotel people who will decide whether this location is good for them, among other real estate businesses. I just want to give you an overview. of what we do, and I'm very pleased that I've been here, and it's my first time to Adelaide. It's a beautiful city from the air, and I think we're going to see it today. Thank you very much for your patience.